yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Well, lots of news, global and U.S. on the agenda here. Well, we're going to talk about the latest in the U.S.-China trade war, i.e. the meeting that's supposed to occur, and the stock market response to it and why, as well as Trump's announcement today about trying to get the IMF to declare China a currency manipulator. What's behind that? I also want to talk about the jobs numbers that came out today. And, of course, interesting events of the past week. Brexit, some observations on Brexit, what's going on there. And then the plan by the Treasury Department, its housing plan, to privatize Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the mortgage companies, the quasi-government mortgage companies. What does that really reflect, and what might be the consequences? Okay, let's jump into it. The U.S.-China dispute. I've been saying, of course, it's not about to be resolved. And okay, so both sides said they'll meet in October. So what? You know, China's not going to refuse not to meet. That doesn't mean that there's going to be any progress made. Because I think China is beginning to realize that the U.S. is not really serious about a mutual trade agreement. The U.S. wants a capitulation by China. It's not going to lift these tariffs, or at least not all of them. And it's demanding a capitulation on the tech issue. And, of course, it's all part of the neocons running U.S. foreign policy. And the election coming up. It's a mess. It's a mess. And there's not going to be any resolution to this anytime soon. But yet, what did we see? Oh, we saw a big shift in the stock markets. The stock markets thought that, whoa, this is a resolution, you know, and they're gyrating back and forth on the slightest news of a resolution to the trade issue. The very slightest news, they jump around. The markets, stock markets I'm talking about. You know, we had this huge increase in stocks here this week. And, of course, that meant money flowed out of the bond market and bond prices went down. You know, they trade off, risk on, risk off. But is there any justification for that kind of a boost in the stock market simply because of a notification that, all right, the two teams will meet in October? There's no agenda, by the way. You know, there's nothing to suggest that anything will come out of this meeting. As I've always said, if there's going to be a resolution, it will be closer to the election. It won't be here in the fall, a whole year, more than a year away from the election. Both economies, China and the U.S., are experiencing some significant strain. You know, look at the U.S. economy. Manufacturing now is in a recession. The U.S. has joined the global manufacturing recession. Of course, commercial property and residential has been contracting now for over a year. So 20%, the goods producing part of the economy, is down in contraction. Business investment is flat or declining. Those are key areas of the U.S. economy that drive the economy, even though it's not a majority of the economy. Majority, of course, is the services side. But that's not the leading sector of the economy. recessions always originate in manufacturing or housing, commercial property, construction, right? And then spill over to services as the contraction of jobs in those former sectors leads to a slowdown in the service sectors, and then we get problems of job creation and unemployment. We'll talk about that a little bit on the report today. And that affects consumption, which is like 2/3, 70% of the economy. Well, consumption's been holding up in the U.S., mostly because of increased credit card debt and other forms of debt going on. And, of course, spending at the very top because of the appreciation in the financial markets that drives the rich folks' spending. Credit debt drives, the median household spending now. And it's not really because there's rising wages. I would refer folks to my post about on my blog, jackrasmus.com, why wages are not really rising 3.1%. And also a post today, what's the real unemployment rate? Check it out. I'm not going to go into the details of that because I want to talk about a number of things here today, not just the jobs report. Okay, so, the stock market goes into these gyrations on the slightest news of trade, up or down. Here's an important statistic. The stock market is not really performing according to fundamentals. Fundamentals, the most important, being corporate profits. Think about this. Last year, in 2018, profits were up immensely because of the Trump tax cuts. But stocks overall were stagnant or down, moving sideways mostly. As opposed to this year, 2019, when profits are definitely slowing, but the stock market is booming. Figure that out. Well, it's not being driven by fundamentals anymore. Why? Well, this is the picture of the stock market. I'm talking about the Dow, the NASDAQ, and so forth, right? S&P 500, most important. There are trillions and trillions of dollars that are accumulated on the sideline by wealthy investors, particularly institutional investors. We're talking about hedge funds, equity firms, private equity firms, those guys. Trillions sitting there. Institutionals, we call these, account for 85% of the stock trades. Corporations, of course, as well, institutions. 85% of the stock trades. It's not your typical small investor. The small investor, we call that the retail investor, has plowed into what's called passive index funds, exchange-traded funds and so forth. These are funds where the investors, the small ones, don't try to pick this or that company stock and how well it's going to do on fundamentals. They just put it in these broad funds, and these funds follow the direction of the general stock market. If it goes up, then the funds go up. Rather than try to figure out what's going on, individual investors got smart enough to figure, well, let's just follow the momentum. Because the momentum's driven by these big institutionals. The hedge fund guys and so forth, 85% of the market. Now, these investors, these hedge funds, these institutionals, trade, buy and sell stocks based upon algorithms. In other words, if the stock market goes down 5 or 6%, boom, in comes the trillions of dollars, some of it on the sidelines, and that demand drives the stocks back up. Or, something else happens and the algorithm says sell. So they sell the stock. Well, who knows about these algorithms, how they're set up and whatever, but the point is, whenever there's an a fundamental correction underway because the economy is slowing or something, right? These trillions on the sideline flood back in based upon some algorithmic buying and selling formula. That's why the stock market should have corrected significantly, but it hasn't. And when it did, at the end of 2018 and earlier this year, by about 20%, boom, here comes the money back in. Drove it back up. You can't understand what's going on unless you understand these institutional buyers and sellers with trillions of dollars in their pocket, trading based upon mathematical formulas, algorithmic trading, followed by the passive indexing ETF retail buyers now, and has nothing to do with fundamentals anymore. Very dangerous situation. What will it take to break the algorithms is the question for them to see a contraction and say, okay, this time we're not plowing our money back in. Well, apparently, you know, 10-20% correction is not enough. And of course, once again, the stock market, you know, took a big surge here this past week on the slightest news that the trade war might be resolved in a meeting coming up in October. First of all, forget it. It's not going to be resolved. And smarter heads have even talked about this and about the market's irrational moves up and down in response to the latest plus or minus news on the trade war. There's more fundamental forces at work in the global and U.S. economy apart from the trade war. But the stock market isn't watching those things. You know, they're moving money in and out, and making profits just on, you know, the surge and the collapse of stock prices. There's this economist. Well, he's more than an economist. He's a big investor. Has worked for some big big bond funds, and I think he's working for this company called Allianz right now. His name is Mohammed El Arian. I follow this guy pretty good because he's I follow what he says. I don't always agree with him, but he tends to be independent and looking at, you know, honestly what's going on. And he has a piece here in the Financial Times today, say, an investor show too much confidence in U.S.-China trade deal. Yeah. And then he goes on to explain how these investors previously were following the latest gyrations in interest rates, but now they're following trade movements or possibility of trade movements. All right. And he's worried about this, as he says, the widening decoupling between asset prices, in other words, stocks, and underlying fundamentals. Right? And two types of dynamics are driving such behavior. The first is the growing influence of algorithms. Yeah. And the headwinds to growth that are coming on stronger and stronger globally and in the U.S. Of course, Europe is the big basket case here, you know. Europe is already at recession, stagnation, you know. Italy's in recession. Germany is very likely already in recession with the latest manufacturing and other reports, industrial production reports. The U.K. is right at the door of recession, probably. Well, it's already contracted one quarter here. And, of course, you don't even have Brexit yet, which is coming. And even if it doesn't come, the impact is on the economy already. It's like, you know, you either die a death of a thousand cuts slowly in Europe, or you, you know, you get assassinated all at once. Talk about economics. If you look at the big five economies in Europe, they're either in trouble or they're about to be. I mean, there's no way with recession in Germany, UK, and Italy that France and Spain won't be dragged in very soon as well. And then you got trillions of dollars in non-performing loans, bank loans, in Europe. And you have $17 trillion, most of it in Europe, of negative interest rates now on various bonds. And you got the central bank about to lower interest rates further into negative territory. Well, negative rates don't solve anything. The argument is that, oh, if banks have to pay the central bank to park their money, they'll invest it, they'll lend it. Well, in a way that's true, but lend it where? Are they going to lend it to business and stimulate business in Europe? Or are they going to lend it somewhere else, you know, like sending it to the U.S. for higher interest rates or to some emerging market that's growing faster than Europe? Yeah, well, that's what they're doing. Bank lending in Europe has collapsed for years. And lowering interest rates even more, a penalty, is only going to cause the further outflow of money capital from Europe. And then you got the problem, even though, let's assume, they would lend to European businesses, well, when the economy is so bad, who wants to borrow the money? Right? Banks may want to lend it, but businesses won't borrow it because there's no demand for their products and their services. Well, that's like a catch-22, isn't it? You can make the cost of money so cheap, but it doesn't mean it's going to result in borrowing or investment. You see, that's the problem with the monetary side of the argument of the economy. This whole idea that if you make money cheap enough, the cost of money will drive investment and therefore employment and GDP. Well, the cost of money is not the only factor in determining investment. And late in the business cycle is the least important factor. Expectations of profitability have a lot to do with factors other than the cost of money. Well, this is pretty basic, but you know, monetarist economists just can't get this straight. This was talked about very clearly by Keynes back in the 1930s. I'll just go and read Keynes all over again. There's a lot of relevance here even for today. I'm not a Keynesian, but you know, you got to acknowledge when someone is right about something, even if you don't totally agree with them, you know? Same with Marx. Some things he said were relevant. Some things are just not relevant at all in the 21st century. I mean, capitalism, the financial system has changed, you know, dramatically. Anyway, not getting off into economic thought and theory too much here. Coming back to Arian, he's correct. He sees it. You know, and I've been saying this too, and he says there are other fundamental problems besides just the slowdown in Europe. I've been saying watch the slowdown in India. Yeah, people aren't paying much attention to that. That's an even deeper instability going on over there. And by the way, I think it explains why their prime minister or leader there, Modi, is making these extreme nationalist moves. Right, that's to divert people from the growing economic problem and to raise the economic nationalism theme as a way of distracting people and blaming others, even internal to your country, for the problems. What has Modi done? Well, he's pretty much sent the military into the northern province called Kashmir and taken it over and introduced martial law and so forth, right? That's a way of stimulating in India Hindu aggressiveness against Muslims, you see, because Kashmir has a large Muslim population as well as an Indian population. Well, you know, go into Kashmir and say, well, you know, raise the nationalist fervor. And now he just did it with in a northeastern province, Assam. the same thing, declaring people who are Indian for decades, many of them non-citizens. Now, this is just the right-wingers whipping up nationalism and creating an internal foreigner as the enemy to distract folks from the economic problems. Well, Monroe's not the only one doing that, is he? Bojo, Boris Johnson in the UK, right? Salvini in Italy, Orban in Hungary, right? They're, and then, of course, in Poland and the Baltics, they're all playing this game and getting away with it. And then, of course, we got Trump, right? And Bolsonaro in Brazil, and Macri in Argentina, and Duterte in the Philippines. You see, it's a game being played all over the world by radical right-wingers who are, you know, on the radical fringe of the capitalist class, who are using the opportunity of resurgent nationalism to assert their control of their capitalist economies. You see, these fights going on are really an internal fight between wings of the capitalist class in these countries. And that's really how you should see Trump in this country, right? Who's behind Trump? You think Trump's just the crazy out there by himself? No way. There's big money behind Trump. And it's the more aggressive wing of the U.S. capitalist class, a lot of them financial capitalists, you see. And you see how he's filled his economy, I mean his cabinet, with former finance capitalists, investment bankers, and so forth. They're helping him run the show. Look, they're all for his tax cuts because it's the finance side that got the big tax cuts on the U.S. multinationals offshore. They're the ones who got the lion's share of that tax cut last year. And by the way, they're behind him on this trade thing, attacking China. Yeah. So don't make the mistake and think that, you know, Trump is just a crazy out there by himself, a lone wolf, right? With maybe, you know, white nationalists and tea parties behind him. No way. This is an internal fight going on between two wings of the capitalist class. And the losers, of course, are the traditionalists who believed in multilateral free trade deals, you know, that have organized around the Democratic Party, right, leadership, the moneybag wing of the Democratic Party, which is doing everything, by the way, to stop Sanders still. This is an internal fight. And that's how it should be viewed, in my view. Now, another indication of Trump's connection to the finance capital wing of this country, speculator wing. Well, he's a speculator himself, right? He's a real estate speculator, wheeler, dealer. You know, he hasn't built anything. Anyway, we get this latest move here a few days ago to privatize the two mortgage, the quasi-government mortgage companies called Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Let's talk about that. What does that represent? What is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac? Well, decades ago, it was created as a government, total, purely government agency, right, that would buy the bonds, the mortgage bonds, from private mortgage companies and banks that, you know, originated mortgages in the housing industry and commercial industry, originated mortgages, and then these private banks, mortgage banks, then sell the mortgages to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. You see, it comes out of the reforms in the 1930s. The housing reforms. Until the Depression in 1930s, just to go back a little bit, mortgages were at most 10 years, that's all. And of course, we had a collapse and destruction of the housing sector in the 1930s. And to protect people or enable them at least to continue their mortgages and not lose their homes. What the government did was establish a number of housing agencies, and the purpose was to enable a 30-year mortgage. Well, you know, if you stretch your payments out over 30 years, your payments per month are far, far less than if you had a mortgage of only 10 years. Well, that kind of put more money in people's pockets to spend. And, you know, the 1930s New Deal was all about that. It was about changing the bankers and the wealthy and their speculative instability-generating ways on one hand, and also a whole number of series of programs and measures to boost the income of households. Well, that was one of them, extending mortgages to 30 years. Well, what does that have to do with Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac? Well, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac are the source of stability for the 30-year mortgage markets. Yeah, they buy up especially 30-year mortgages that are sold to them, fixed interest rate mortgage in particular. And in the 1970s or 80s, I think, they partially privatized Fannie and Freddie. In other words, they're still government agencies, and they must buy, according to the rules, any mortgages the banks sell to them. They don't have a choice. They must buy them. Right? And they were allowed to issue their own stock. Okay, they're a government agency, but they issue their own stock to raise, you know, internal funds. That's Fannie Freddie. And in the run-up to the latest crisis in 2007-08, we know heavily housing crisis, right? They were required to buy up, absorb from banks in trouble the massive amount of new mortgages were being issued. You know, part of the problem of the crisis in 2008-09 was that you had banks just issuing as many of these mortgages as they can, the quantity, and not looking at the quality of the borrower, just the quantity, and then they would sell these mortgages. Well, as it looked like they were getting to a crisis, they dumped these mortgages more and more on Freddie and Fannie. Well, Freddie and Fannie in 2008 ended up with a lot of these bad mortgages. But now Freddie and Fannie had stock, right? Issued stock. Well, it looked like Freddie and Fannie were going to go bankrupt now because they had all of this excess bad mortgages, and their stock began declining. And then the speculators jumped in and shorted the stock and drove it down to virtually nothing. So that in July of 2008, the U.S. government had to come in and bail out Freddie, $200, $300 billion, right? That was the first real big financial institution that crashed in 2008. Well, there was another one, Bear Stearns Investment Bank, in March of 2008, but the Fannie and Freddie started that whole ball rolling downhill, financial institutions crashing. But they were bailed out. But when they were bailed out, then Secretary Paulson said, okay, we're not going to bail anybody out anymore. Right? Well, that declaration was a signal to speculators to short the prices of other financial institutions like Washington Mutual, Merrill Lynch, and, of course, the infamous Lehman Brothers. And when they did not bail out Lehman Brothers, then the whole thing got worse. And then, you know, Washington Mutual and all the others, Merrill Lynch, they all collapsed. Bank of America and Citigroup, their stock prices were driven low by to nothing by speculators. They were technically bankrupt, you know, should have gone under like Lehman Brothers. But after Lehman Brothers, the government said, no, we can't let them go under too, and bailed them out to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars for Citigroup and Bank of America. Okay. So Fannie and Freddie had something to do with precipitating the whole financial crisis, because Fannie and Freddie were holding all these bad mortgages, and the government bailed them out. Now, Fannie and Freddie held on to those bad mortgages, and as the price of mortgages recovered over the next 10 years, 7-10 years, after 2008, right, Fannie and Freddie made a profit. And the profit, of course, because it was a quasi-government agency, went to the U.S. government. Just like the Federal Reserve made a profit on buying up bad loans and, turned that profit over to the U.S. Treasury. That kind of irked private investors. Why can't we make that profit that Fannie and Freddie is making? That's not fair. They want to make the profit off of Fannie and Freddie, but they don't want to take the risk of absorbing the losses when there's a crisis. But that's what, nationalization under capitalism is really about. You nationalize the failures, and then when they are recovered, you then privatize, sell it off to the capitalists again. So the taxpayer takes the losses and the private capitalists take the profits, you see. Well, that's what's going on with Fannie Freddie. There's been a movement by capitalists originally under Obama to privatize Fannie Freddie. In other words, sell it off to private investors. Obama raised that possibility, but it didn't go anywhere. Well, now you got Trump and his Treasury Department doing just that, raising that possibility again, saying, let's sell it off to private investors. Well, if you sell it to private investors, you're then going to have to issue an IPO, a new stock issuance, an IPO. Well, the private investors will jump in, buy the stock on the IPO, and when the stock appreciates because it goes private, make a big killing. In other words, what's behind this with Trump is to provide a big windfall, speculative profit, by privatizing Fannie and Freddie for his hedge fund and other speculator investment buddies. That's what this is about. Sell it off so the speculators can make a big capital gain immediately when it goes private. And then whoever buys the stock can cash in on the longer term profits that Fannie and Freddie may make as well. It's just another capitalist game. That's all this is about. Now, the problem is when and if it goes private, the 30-year mortgages are going to rise in cost. And if the 30-year fixed mortgage rises, it drives up the rest of the mortgage rate. So in other words, you're going to have a big income transfer from folks who buy homes when under privatized Fannie Freddie, buy the homes. They're going to pay more mortgages. And the speculators are going to essentially take that money. They'll get it all up front, and then the buyers of those mortgages, households, will pay the tab across a number of years with higher mortgage rates. But that's how capitalism works, on the financial side especially. Yeah. Well, that's what's behind this Fannie Freddie and privatization. Now, I talk about in my forthcoming book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, Economic Policy from Reagan to Trump. When I talk about Trump and Obama, I talk about deregulation and privatization as important parts of what's called neoliberal industrial policy, right? Privatize, deregulate, and how that has evolved and continues to evolve. Also, industrial policy involves deunionization. I'll talk about that, explain and show how that's continuing. Holding down wages, wage compression, that's part of it. Shifting jobs to part-time, temp, contingent, and gig work. That's part of industrial policy, right? But not just industrial policy and its evolution from Reagan through Trump, but also monetary policy, you know, Federal Reserve interest rate policy, and external policy, which is really trade wars, and currency exchange, right? Tariffs and so forth, external policy, and then fiscal policy, which is really tax cuts, mostly for business and investors, at the same time, a rise in war and defense spending for that sector of the capitalist economy, and at the same time, austerity for social programs. There are four main policy areas of neoliberalism. And this mix, industrial policy, monetary policy, fiscal policy, and external trade policy, dollar policy, is a particular mix that we call neoliberalism, you see. We didn't have that kind of mix before Reagan. It was a different kind of mix. And neoliberalism is not really about free markets. It has nothing to do with free markets. That's just an ideological obfuscation. There's nothing free about markets under neoliberalism. If neoliberalism is really about squeezing other classes, you see, squeezing working classes in their own countries and more aggressively competing and trying to gain an advantage in international markets with their capitalist competitors elsewhere around the world. That's what neoliberalism is about. And one of the main arguments I make in the book is that this neoliberalism that evolved and expanded aggressively from Reagan through George W. Bush hit a kind of a wall in 2008-09. Obama couldn't put it back together again, and you should understand Trump as an effort to restore that, but in even more aggressive, virulent form, call it neoliberalism 2.0 if you wish, that we see evolving now in front of us. And a good part of the book deals with proving that thesis and showing how neoliberalism is being restored on a more aggressive level under Trump. Both the attack on the rest of the U.S. society, in other words, income inequality is an expression of that. It's a symptom of that, as well as an attack on U.S. capitalist competitors. That's what the trade war is really about, you see, especially the competitors, the big ones called China. Okay, so that's enough of a preview of the book. The book comes out October 1st, and in subsequent shows between now and then, I will be talking about different chapters of that book. Okay, so enough for Fannie Freddie, enough for what's really behind China-U.S. trade. And by the way, I don't think I mentioned, but maybe I did briefly, but Trump today has announced he's putting pressure on the IMF to declare China a currency manipulator. Well, what's behind that? Well, because if China allows its currency to devalue, it will simply offset U.S. tariffs. There'll be no advantage by U.S. tariffs. And Trump is terrified that China will do just that. And China will allow its currency to break out of the band that it's been keeping it in relationship to the U.S. dollar. You know, the upper level of that band is 7.1 Chinese yuan, or one, to the dollar. If there is more than, if it rises to 7.5 or 8 to the dollar, that's a devaluation, you see. But if you look at the evidence, China is not trying to devalue it. In fact, just the opposite, is trying to stabilize it and keep it within the bound of 7.1 or less. So how is it a currency manipulator? It's not. It's not a currency manipulator. And Trump knows that. And the U.S. knows that. But it's a good weapon and a kind of a threat to China. Well, don't think about doing this. You know, declare I'm a currency manipulator now, and that's kind of a warning. Don't think about allowing your currency to devalue. But you see, China and all countries don't have total control over whether their currency revalues or devalues, because it's always at least half due to the other country and its currency moving up or down. So if the dollar moves up, the yuan will naturally move down. The relationship is, you know, inverse. So the problem with China's currency edging towards devaluation is not that China's trying to make it devalue, just the opposite. It's that the dollar is rising in value, and that in turn lowers the yuan. So the U.S. is manipulating its currency. Well, it's not actually manipulating it. It's just that the dollar is rising. Why? Because the rest of the global economy is slowing much faster than the U.S. And capitalists over in the rest of the economies in Europe and Latin America and elsewhere are taking their currencies that are falling in value and converting it to dollars that are rising in value. And converting it to dollars raises the demand for the dollars, raises the price of the dollar, which drives it up. The U.S. is causing these currencies to devalue. Or you could argue at least that it's the big gap between the growth in Europe and elsewhere and in the U.S., which isn't that great, but is greater than in Europe and Japan. So the money capital is flowing into the U.S., flowing into the dollar, driving up the dollar, and driving down the Chinese currency. But China's been entering the markets to try to slow that. It's doing the opposite. But this is a tactic by Trump in the trade war with China. It's kind of a way of intensifying. You know, saying what it did today is a way of intensifying the pressure on China, which makes it less likely that China's going to respond when they meet in October. Okay. Let's go back to Europe. And talk about Brexit a little bit. And then I want to talk about the jobs report here today. Brexit. Well, intensifying over there, isn't it? The war over Brexit. And you've got Bojo, Boris Johnson, the new prime minister, you know, saying, well, we're going to leave hard Brexit. In other words, we're going to leave the European Union, customs union. Customs union is... holding down tariffs or no tariffs on goods moving across the different countries. Europe, the European Union is a customs union, but a customs union that allows free labor mobility across the countries, not just capital mobility. You see, if you look at Britain, what happened here in recent decades is that British capital moved out of Britain, and it moved into East Europe in large volume. And that's why those East European countries are doing so well. And, you know, German capital did the same, French capital did the same, you know, and boosting the economies in, you know, Hungary, Poland, and so forth. Right? Now, in exchange, you had capital mobility moving from those countries to Britain. Over a million workers alone moved from Poland into Britain. And that, of course, raised the whole thing about immigration into Britain. And Britain had the other problem that it still maintained the fiction of the British Commonwealth, and it increasingly allowed immigrants coming from Asia, South Asia, you know, Indians, Pakistanis, and so forth, into Britain. So you had this massive immigration inflow, which, you know, eventually led to this social issue of, you know, because we're part of the European Union, we have to allow this, but what's happening to Britain here is they're taking all our jobs, right? And then you got an opportunist like the former Conservative Prime Minister Cameron, who said, okay, you know, I'll have a referendum on it. Just elect me first and I'll let you do a referendum, British voters. So they elected him. In other words, he sold that whole problem and the Brexit referendum in order to get reelected for another term, or however they do it. And he let the genie out of the bottle. And that's what you got here right now. They're trying to put that genie back in the bottle because the referendum said Britain must leave the UK. But the British capitalists are saying, whoa, wait a minute, we don't want to leave the UK. We're going to investors and the wealthy. We're going to lose a lot of money if we leave the UK. I mean, leave the EU, if the UK leaves the EU. So you have this battle going on with Parliament reflecting those interests, saying, no, we can't afford to leave the EU. It would be a disaster. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what's really going on. Well, if they left the EU and a hard Brexit, what would happen? Well, first of all, the British pound would accelerate its decline. It's already contracted significantly, but it would accelerate once they did a hard Brexit. Well, think about it. You know, all the wealthy people with their investment in British pounds, right? And the value of the pound declines, and therefore, you know, overnight, they lose a big proportion, maybe a third of their wealth. Well, they're opposed to that. They don't want to take the risk and see their wealth evaporate overnight because of the currency decline. The same thing with the stock market over there in the UK. It would certainly decline, it has, but even more so, and they'd lose even more wealth values. And what about the profits of companies in the UK? You know, they make a lot of money for selling things in the European mainland. Well, they probably wouldn't be able to sell them because overnight the price would rise because tariffs would be imposed. And of course, you would have tariffs on the British side for imported semi-finished goods that would be needed, or imports of even consumer goods, which would result in less purchases and less profits from revenue sales, less profits from price increases. In other words, corporate profits, business profits, take a big hit with a hard Brexit, just as stock values, right, and currency collapse would take a big hit out of those who have wealth. And that's why those folks are so opposed to leaving the European Union in a hard Brexit. And they have their constituency in Parliament. Now, not all the opposition to a hard Brexit is a reflection of capitalist interests, but the big part of it is. Right? That's why they don't want a hard Brexit. They don't want to leave. Right? Okay. Now, the pro-Brexiteers say that, oh, you know, we would be more competitive. We don't need Europe. We could sell our stuff elsewhere around the world even more cheaply. Maybe we would lose in Europe the market share, but we would gain more elsewhere because we wouldn't be hampered by the euro or European, well, not the euro so much, but European rules and regulations that add cost to the product. Well, this is kind of a fantasy. You know, they think they got their old British Empire and they'll be able to make more money that way. They're deluding themselves. Or they say, hey, you know, we'll have a special deal, a special relationship with the USA and a trade deal with the USA. Forget it. The USA isn't going to give them any special deal. Or they say, well, we could have the same relationship Norway has. It enjoys the customs union, but it's not really part of it. Well, Europe isn't going to agree to that, because if it agrees to that at this point with the UK, then it's just encouraging other countries and economies within the European Union and the customs union to do the same. It would cause an entropy. In other words, the EU would spin out of control, with more and more wanting to exit. That's why the European, the continentals, are driving a hard bargain with the UK. They want the UK to suffer as a warning to the rest of the countries in the European Union and the Eurozone, the currency zone, right? That, hey, this is what happens if you leave us. You better not leave us, okay? So that's what's going on with Brexit. But, you know, Bojo, Boris Johnson, is an example of this rightward shift everywhere. Trump in the U.S., right? Salvini in Italy, Orban, others in Europe, right? Modi in India, Duterte in the Philippines, right? It's the same thing happening everywhere. It's a reflection of this growing crisis in capitalistic global economy being reflected in institutional instability and a us versus them splits even within the capitalist class as well. All right, so let's finish up with a talk a little bit about the job numbers. What do we got? Well, today the job numbers come out. 130,000. Now, remember, it takes about 130,000, maybe 150,000 of new jobs to be created just to absorb new entrants into the labor force. You know, people who might have left it coming back in, or people, you know, just joining the labor force, you know, youth or coming out of college or whatever, just joining the labor force. You need to create in the U.S. at least 130,000. So 130,000 new jobs in August means they're just marking time. But it's not really 130,000 new jobs in the private sector. No. See, because in that 130,000, there are like 22,000 or more of census workers that are being hired. And those numbers will increase every month by roughly the same amount. So we're really only growing about 100,000 jobs a month, which means we're not absorbing permanent entrants into the labor force. Now, this has been a growing trend over the last several months, because the report that came out with 130,000 also downward revised the job numbers for the two previous months, June and July. Okay. And then, of course, we had a month, I forget when it was, April or whatever, when we had job creation well below. Last year, average monthly job creation, I think, is like 220,000. This year, it's about 150. So what we see is a slowing in the job creation category here, which is indicative of a typical lagging indicator, and that's what jobs are. The recession, other indicators will show it's coming, like business investment, leading indicator, and others will follow once the recession momentum is well underway, like jobs. And I think we're beginning to see jobs softening as a leading, as a lagging indicator. We're beginning to see its indication, although lagged, from the rest of the economy, because, as I said before, manufacturing is in a recession, construction is in a recession in the U.S., business investment is probably in a recession, flat at best, on plant and equipment, right? So now we're beginning to see weakness on the job front. We'll see a lot more weakness on the job front once business stops hiring. Well, depends on the industry, but business will slow hiring. And therefore, stronger indication will occur, even less job creation will occur in the coming months. Well, why will it stop hiring or slow hiring? Because people will be buying less and less of their goods and services, particularly on the consumer side. Well, why will they be buying less and less? Because the price will be rising for goods and services. Well, why was the price rising? Because of the tariffs and the trade war. Chase Bank has estimated that already, on average, households have paid $600 out of pocket because of the trade war. $600. And that, starting this month, will go to $1,000 because the new tariffs imposed this week now are mostly on consumer goods. You see, the previous rounds of tariffs on China really hit business goods, you know, business to business. This is going to be consumer goods. Yeah. It's going to start taking a bite out of consumption. Prices are going to rise. It's going to take a bite out of consumption here, increasingly. The trade war. And that will be reflected with a lag in slowing growth of consumption. And that's the only thing holding up GDP right now. Yeah, you got war spending too. But that's really it. That's the big factor, because the other key areas are down. You know, the trade deficit with China is not improving, despite a year and a half of trade war and tariffs on, well, at least $375 billion more. It hasn't really adjusted to a trade surplus with the U.S. In other words, it's not working. Tariffs don't work. And there's signs that China is preparing for a long haul on the trade front. So that brings us back to our initial point at the beginning of the show. I don't want to go over that again. Let's continue on the jobs picture. Okay, so we really have 108,000 jobs created this month. Now, it's interesting that the Labor Department came out with a report about a week or so ago that said, oh, they overestimated the job creation between June 2018 and June 2019 by 500,000 jobs. Yeah, they counted 500,000 more than they should have. You know, they make that adjustment every year when they really get all the data. Because, look, this isn't a reporting of actual jobs. This is a statistic, which means you take the actual number of jobs and you do various statistical manipulations of that to come up with a statistic. That's what a statistic is. It's a manipulation of the data. So they manipulated wrongly last year, and now they're correcting it, and we got 500,000 less jobs. Well, last year, over the same period, the economy created 1.1 million. Well, they've adjusted that. Does that mean they've adjusted it by 500,000? Whoa, that's a big error, if they have, if that's it. Wasn't clear to me in looking at this report last week, 500,000 fewer jobs created. By the way, I talk about that on my blog, jackrasmus.com. Go read the print version of that. Yeah, well, how reliable are these job numbers, actually, you know? Makes one wonder. You see, the Labor Department counts jobs in its survey every month. It doesn't count employed workers. The assumption is you create a job, some unemployed worker is now employed, right? No, no, no. You can create second and third part-time jobs for the same worker who was already employed with a first part-time job. And I think that's actually what's happening. We're creating more and more part-time jobs and temp jobs, gig jobs, but we're not creating that much more employment of people who didn't have a job, now got a job. Well, that's my hypothesis anyway, that we're all the, even these job numbers, as weakening as they are becoming, are really reflecting second and third job creation. Okay, next week, I'm sure we're going to have some further interesting news.